Electoral Count Act passes the House, Putin mobilizes, and Stacey Abrams does her best amateur cardiology. We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook Medal and Maddie Kearns and the notorious M.B.D. Michael Brendan Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsors this episode are NetChoice, Tommy John, and Segura. More about them in due course. For some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So, as I mentioned, today we are brought to you by NetChoice, a trade organization dedicated to free expression and free enterprise online. Tech services have empowered American seniors to stay connected to the issues and people they care about, but they've been harsh targets of cyber criminals and scammers looking for ways to extract personal information and money, hack into accounts, and steal identities. Because of this, seniors expect quality care from American tech companies, which offer world-leading security protections. A bill moving through Congress called the Open App Markets Act will open seniors up to more scams and hacking by banning app stores from removing dangerous apps and payment software. Don't expose our seniors to more hurt, confusion, and online theft. Tell Congress to vote no on the Open App Markets Act. So, MBD, speaking of Congress, they had some action this week from a House. They very quickly took up and passed reforms of the Electoral Count Act. A lot of these, I think, are common sense measures. There's some that differ from the version in the are less desirable and probably should be blocked. But what do you make of it?
Well, I agree with you that it is a salutary reform. For the first reason is because Congress, in a way, had to respond to January 6th and had to, for its own like manhood as a branch of government, find a way to shut down anyone else who thought that there was something about the way the electoral votes were counted in the House that, you know, gave the vice president discretion on which electors to count at all. And this reform is almost a do-no-harm bill, right? Like, it just clarifies and removes ambiguity and provides a little bit of reassurance around the edges, just some institutional bumpers. And for that, I'm grateful, because it would be easy to do something silly and wrong. And the Democrats' first instinct was that we should effectively nationalize the presidential election and have the federal government run it according to principles that the Democrats themselves would draw up unilaterally. And that would have been a disaster. And I worried that initial push was going to block doing something like this. So now, seeing this come about, I'm pleased. There may be some little detail that surprises us in the future, but so far it looks good.
So, Maddie, just a couple thoughts. One, I'm not sure why we needed January 6th committee hearings to get to this. It seems as though they're rushing to do this to show, hey, look, here's the outcome of these committee hearings, where you easily could have debated and passed this bill prior to the January 6th committee hearings, whatever you think of that committee's work. And then also, the process isn't great here. I mean, the Senate, there is extensive bipartisan negotiations, all sorts of debate about it, hearings, and this, they come up with the legislative text on Monday, and then a couple of days later have slammed it through and have done it. Well, I guess you can look at this two ways. Either just Republicans are too craven to do anything that might cross Donald Trump, which would not be an unusual phenomenon, or they've kind of been put off by the partisan nature of this. And especially, you know, Liz Cheney has become highly radioactive, obviously, for Republicans, and she is a big champion of this. But you only had 9 Republicans voting for it.
Yeah, it's sort of depressing that you only had 9 Republicans voting for it. But as you mentioned, the Democrats had an opportunity to push this earlier. They didn't make it a priority because it's not as politically useful as the theater involved with the committee and basically replaying January 6th over and over again. And in the same way, I think Democrats have benefited from the fact that Trump does still have a hold over the Republican Party. And that's been evident in the way they are invested, sometimes financially invested in pushing pro-Trump candidates for Republican primaries. This has served their interest. This seeming resistance from some people has served their interest. Of course, at this point, I think it was actually Mitt Romney who said this, the priority ought to be for the good of the country is getting this passed, getting some form of this. Okay, it's not perfect. Democrats obviously wanted more of the voting rights stuff in there. Republicans have their reservations, but there is a remarkable bipartisan compromise here. They could pass this, and that should be the priority. And as Mitt Romney said, if Schumer continues to drag his feet in holding a debate and a vote on this, it really just proves that they're being disingenuous, that they just want to show that Republicans are unwilling to protect elections and less interested in making sure January 6th doesn't happen again.
So, Charlie, what do you think of this bill on the merits?
I think that it is better than it is worse. And I think the Senate should pass it. I see this endeavor as a necessity, given that people being Donald Trump and those who helped him, have begun to lie about the law. Slightly different context, but I am, for example, a supporter of the 22nd Amendment as a way of codifying what had been for a long time in America a tradition that presidents would only seek two terms. Once we had a president who went for three, I think it was good that Congress said, no, actually, we'd like to make that official. I would like to see something similar happen with the Supreme Court, cap it at 9 members, and I think Electoral Count Act reform fulfills the same function. Nobody in the last century had ever tried to do with the 12th Amendment and the Electoral Count Act what Donald Trump tried to do. Nobody thought it meant that. It was an attempted coup. The Electoral Count Act fix is designed to make clear what was, if you squint, unclear, but have been culturally clear for a long time. And as such, I think it's a useful use of Congress's time. There are some provisions within it that are slightly more malleable than I would have liked, but it does the main thing that it needed to do, which is ensure that this reform does not get hijacked and turned into a means by which every single objection that is raised is elevated to a federal cause of action. So I think there is very little reason not to vote for it, because even if you think that the altered act is imperfect, it is clearly better than the ambiguity that it is seeking to replace.
So MBD mentioned just 9 House Republicans voted for it, obviously looking over their shoulders at Trump and not wanting to provoke his ire. So what's your current temperature on Trump's hold on the party? You had a poll in Florida that had DeSantis leading Trump. I think there's a similar poll 3 months or so ago at a time when actually DeSantis was beginning to tie or lead Trump in a number of state polls, including notably New Hampshire, but that was before the Mar-a-Lago raid, which kind of blew that all up. And you had a national poll, I think it was a Fox one, that again had Trump, 56 and DeSantis 19, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, Trump still has a grip on the party, and I think it is potentially strong enough. If the primaries were all held today, I think he would win handily. If we had a primary contest starting today, I think at the end of it, he would likely win the nomination. But I don't think he is strong enough to win a general election. I think we can tell because he lost the previous one. And I think we can tell because it's sort of like the shine is off the penny. There's no way for the coalition he assembled in 2016 for every member of that to come away from the last 6 years and feel that he was an effective president. He did what he said he was going to do. partly because he originally promised so many things that were contradictory to each other. We're going to bring the boys home. We're going to take the oil. We're going to, you know, turn the Middle East into a piece of glass. We're going to have peace in our times. He couldn't satisfy all of those people that he appealed to. So I don't think they'll show up. And in the meantime, there is the attempt by other Republican figures like DeSantis to move the party past Trump has been tentative and implicit rather than like explicit and bold. So, you know, right now, I think you just have to grade him as the poll leader. And, you know, we're stuck with him until someone pushes him out.
You know, the controversy over the Martha Vineyard flights just brought home to me just how important just attention is. It's like gold, you know, and that's what Trump realized in 15, 16 that other Republicans didn't so much. But, you know, Trump benefited from the Mar-a-Lago raid because it made him front and center. And then you could see another a vista again where maybe he's eclipsed, you know, and DeSantis is the main guy because DeSantis was the focus for a couple days there. But Charlie, let's go exit question to you back on the Electoral Count Act. The Electoral Count Act, Electoral Count Act reform will pass Congress, yes or no? If it does pass, we'll be closer to the Senate or the House version.
The Senate version. And it will pass.
And it will pass. Matty Kearns.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Whoops, just dropped my phone. MBD.
Make it unanimous, yeah. Senate version, it'll pass.
I will keep it unanimous. It will pass in the lame duck session, and it will be the Senate version, or at least much closer to the Senate version. And I was picking up my phone. I was picking it up to share a Tommy John read with everyone here. Fall is chaos on your pants. You're overheating one second and freezing the next. To be ready for anything, you need underwear that can handle everything. It's time for Tommy John underwear. And Tommy John underwear, you're that much more comfortable, so you can do everything better. Name a problem with other underwear, and Tommy John's solved it. Tommy John's a breathable, lightweight fabric, has four times the stretch of competing brands. They come with a no-wedgie guarantee thanks to a non-rolling waistband and legs that never ride up. Plus, they feature a horizontal quick-draw fly. Hammock pouch gives you the support you need, giving everyone something to be grateful for. With over 17 million pairs sold, people love Tommy John underwear. That's why Tommy John doesn't have customers. They have fanatics. Plus, everything's backed with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear, or it's free. Guarantee. Go to TommyJohn.com/editors right now for 20% off your first order. 20% off at TommyJohn.com/editors. TommyJohn.com/editors. Please check it out and see the site for details. So, MBD. We've had various stages in the Ukraine war. There was the initial, what was supposed to be a lightning strike on Kiev strategy that failed. Then you had the march on Kiev that failed. Then you had the artillery war in the east and the south that Russia was winning. Then you had the Ukrainians finally getting more advanced artillery from the west and launching a successful counteroffensive. Although it's clear they're not just going to sweep to victory. They're having more trouble in the south than they did in the north. And now, next stage, you can see it coming here. Putin has announced a mobilization, or at least a mobilization of the reserves, 300,000 men. You've seen these amazing pictures of protests, you know, small scale, the scheme of things, maybe the number I saw, 1,300 people in Moscow. That's not easy to do. In contemporary Russia, you've had reports of flights being booked up out of Russia. You've had these amazing pictures, huge traffic jams at border crossings as people are leaving. But then also the other side of the ledger, you know, pictures of men duly lined up getting into transport planes or getting onto buses. And I have to say, some of these guys, these reservists, you know, they look like they're my age. These are not, you know, it's not just affecting young single men who are, you know, looking for an adventure. These guys with families. So you've followed this closely. What are you thinking?
I mean, I think it's Putin is is in effect acknowledging that the invasion has failed to achieve its objectives, and without a huge redirection of the war effort, it will fail utterly to do so, and Russia will lose the war. So he's hunkering down, he's doubling down, he's escalating, he is preparing potentially for a very long war. I mean, this many of these troops may be used to relieve and allow the previous units who've been regular units who've been sent in Ukraine to regather themselves, to heal up, to take a break before returning to the front again. This plan for mobilization will take months, though, very likely, because it means these aren't troops who are ready to go right away. Many of them have to be retrained. They have to be outfitted with equipment. And at least Western analysts question whether Russia can properly outfit them with modern weaponry or and the skills to use it in a short time. So it's very serious, and it very likely means the war will drag on and be bloodier. We do have to remember, though, that in effect, what Putin is doing something on the Russian side of the war that Ukraine has kind of already had to do, right? Like Ukraine's whole society and economy is now mobilized to the war because it's a war for their own territory and potentially maybe even their survival as a viable nation state, depending on how far Putin is willing to go. So it's not like there's an obvious move Ukraine can now do to escalate. If the Ukrainian side of the war is going to escalate, that's a decision that'll be taken by NATO, frankly. It'll be taken by us as their chief sponsor and their chief armory. So I still believe this war is very dangerous. I believe it can get out of control. I believe that imaginable endings for this conflict are mostly unpleasant and horrible for everyone. And, you know, I also look back at my kind of early predictions. I thought that potentially Putin would have a victory parade in one eastern Ukrainian city by the end of the year. That is out. But my prediction that in the end the war would be a disaster for Russia as well is definitely proving to be true. I do worry. I mean, I don't know. There are lots of things we don't know about the Ukrainian, the state of things in Ukraine and the Ukrainian strength of their remaining forces. But one thing that did kind of light me up and worry me was when General Shoigu, the kind of Tuvan commander of the armed forces, said that they were going to change the rules of engagement in Ukraine, and now they would begin targeting NATO operators who are assisting Ukrainians. We have no official reports of this assistance, but the way that the Ukrainian Air Force has been able to stay in the air suggests that Polish and maybe U.S. people are there, maybe on maybe many of them on a volunteer basis.
Training, repairing,
and doing, helping with logistics. I doubt sitting in heavy armory and fighting. But if it's true and Russia begins killing, we start hearing more reports of Americans and Poles dying in Ukraine. I mean, that could begin moving public opinion in an escalatory way. So I'm worried.
So good. That's a new state for you.
A new statement.
So Maddie, one just obvious thought I've had the last couple of days is just how much leadership matters and just the cost of having a malicious idiot in charge of a country with a lot of power. And, you look at someone like Bismarck, who is not a nice guy, who is profoundly cynical and wanted to aggrandize Prussia and create Germany and precipitated wars to do it, but then always had a sense of how not to push things too far and how to balance even within his aims. And Putin has just made a catastrophic mistake here. He never should have launched this war, and it has no way out except for doubling down, which is going to be a disaster for Ukraine and is going to be a disaster for Russia and could lead to some very scary outcomes.
Yeah. So the New York's been pretty busy this week with the UN General Assembly, and it's striking how isolated Russia is. And but in a way, this is sort of the least of his worries, right? I mean, obviously, he has these huge economic problems and sanctions, although he's fighting back pretty hard with that. And we have our next cover story of National Review is on this European energy crisis, which he's pretty much precipitated. But the bigger problem for Putin, and has always been for Putin, is domestically what's going on in Russia. Can the Russian people get behind this? And I think this is actually where he's always been at a disadvantage to Ukraine, because for the Ukrainians, once they've been invaded, they've really got nothing to lose and actually something even to die for. There's meaning here. Whereas for Russians, I mean, he's still not even acknowledging this is a war. He's saying this is a special military operation. I mean, imagine sort of, they're reservists just now, but the next step after that would be conscription. And people don't want to give down their life for something that they don't understand what's the point of this. They've got everything to lose. And this is the problem for Putin, is that his entire strength and in what he's doing, it depends on his ability to sell this propaganda. And I think that's why these protests, and yes, okay, they're relatively small, but as you point out, it's a big thing to protest in modern day Russia. That's why it's very telling. I think he's becoming increasingly desperate. And as he becomes increasingly desperate, I think increasingly dangerous. I'm certainly not content just to sort of think that his threats of nuclear weapons is just a bluff. I mean, it may well not be. He's not behaving rationally.
I mean, his exit strategy from the Chechen war was basically to level the place with bombs and then install a couple of family psychos to be in charge of it for him, with very light connections to him, and then exit it before he got totally embarrassed. So, I mean, he's very capable of deciding, I can't win on my conventional terms. I'm just going to make a giant mess, run away, and declare it a victory.
Yeah, it seems to me that would be, you know, further step down the road if the mobilization doesn't lead to the results he wants. But I don't totally discount the possibility. Charlie.
Well, this is hardly a novel insight, but it does demonstrate the extent to which having nuclear weapons helps you. Mm-hmm. Because that's the one thing everyone keeps going back to. It's the one red flag at the end of the logic chain. But what if he were to use the nuclear weapons? And the reason for that is that this excursion, devastating though it has been, has revealed a certain weakness. And we're seeing that weakness yet again. Think about how militaries like to portray themselves. Think about the average recruiting ad you see during football on a Sunday. Good looking, muscular young men and women now, with clean, shiny firearms, flying clean, shiny planes, landing on clean, shiny aircraft carriers, walking around in perfect unison, maybe a couple of explosions, bit of teamwork. And then look at the photographs that we're seeing from the recruiting offices, if you can call them that, in Russia. It's hardly awe-inspiring, is it? We're seeing people being dragged off the streets and told they're going to the front. And yet, because of the nuclear weapons, we're all scared. And rightfully so. Ukraine is scared. No one's quite sure. There's that element of uncertainty. Without those nuclear weapons, I think it would look rather pathetic. I've been, I think, impressed by two factors here. The first is that Russia is weaker than I thought. Now, I'm no expert, but the routine displays of weakness have surprised me. And the second is that no one is as weak as we think they are when they have nuclear weapons in their arsenal, because their use would be so catastrophic and such a break with international norms that it unfortunately leaves everyone guessing.
So, Charlie, I just thought of this when you were talking about people getting dragged off the streets. You know, one of the most terrifying aspects of British history, in my mind, is naval impressment. It was just horrible.
I agree with you there.
I mean, it just, you know, grabbed, and you're basically instantly in this totally brutal form of service in the British Navy.
Yeah, and the what you really, really want to ensure if you find yourself in that predicament is that your commanding officer isn't crazy.
Mm-hmm.
This was a mainstay of British literature in the late 18th and mid 19th centuries, was Navy reservists or you know, mainstream rank and file members who found themselves on a ship somewhere around the world, and their commanding officer went mad, and they had to mutiny because that was the only thing that could have kept mm-hmm. them alive, which was a capital offense. And then, you know, I think this is a subplot in the novel North and South, the British one, not the American one, where one of the brothers of the main characters is on the run, I think is hiding in Cadiz, and eventually sneaks back to England. But if he's caught, he would be executed. Well, I think I'm right in saying this would happen occasionally with impressed soldiers. So you'd be walking around somewhere minding your own business, and you suddenly get sort of grabbed off the street and sent to a ship. Then your commanding officer goes crazy. You have to mutiny. And now if you get caught, you'll be executed. And you must sort of have sat there after 6 months thinking, what on earth did I do to deserve this? Yeah.
But imagine how low the morale of Russian soldiers could be right now. I mean, you go in, even if you're a regular soldier, you go in, you probably do believe, as Putin argued, that Ukrainians are in some ways like kinfolk. You may have relatives who were born in Kharkiv or wherever. You go into this country, you confront locals who you are told you're saving them from Nazis, and they're screaming at you to get out of their country. And then you're being harassed by, very effectively, by Turkish drones that were paid for by Americans, and probably six Ukrainians got rich in the transaction. It's total national humiliation for Russia.
Yeah, you're poorly trained, and you're put in a unit that is, might be severely depleted and not in great shape to begin with, and you don't want to be there. It's extraordinary, and a reflection, as some people pointed out, you know, militaries reflect their country's cultures, and Russia is a country basically that hasn't gotten it right throughout its entire history. Now, I guess it succeeded in its term, you know, expanding, dominating parts of Europe for long periods of time, but this is a political culture that has just been profoundly illiberal and incompetent for as far as the eye can see.
Yeah.
So Maddie Kern's exit question to you: in 2 years, Vladimir Putin will still be president of Russia, yes or no?
Yes, I think so.
Joy Cook?
I mean, my answer is effectively worthless because I don't know anything about it. But given my
It's never stopped you before, Charlie.
My bias toward the status quo, I'm going to assume he will be.
All right, we got two yeses on the board. MBD.
Yeah, Niall Ferguson argued persuasively at the beginning of the war that if you just look in history, leaders are not replaced. Wartime leaders are not replaced because of their failures almost ever until the war's concluded. They're rarely ever replaced, and I would expect him.
You've had a couple revolutions in Russia, though, precipitated by military.
You've had, but I mean, I would just caution people. I mean, the big caution I would have for people who think like, oh, there's going to be a bad news cycle for Putin, and then like someone is going to kill him, is like, one, if that were the reality, that someone would probably be much more terrifying than Putin. and just recall that like Russian coups in the Kremlin, like the last one in the 90s was a complete disaster for Russia that led to Putin. And the one before that was a planetary disaster.
Yeah. I remember the coup against Gorbachev. Those guys are just such clearly like jokers, just wearing the track suits. I mean, they did not look like the respectable members of a junta. I would say I don't discount the possibility of Putin falling. I mean, there is some chance at some point, just all of a sudden, he looks really weak, you know, and no longer in control. And that would be a really dangerous moment for him. Yeah. But that, you know, the chances of that are relatively slim.
A real blow for democracy.
Yeah, I'm going to be I'm going to go with everyone else and say yes with that. Let's hear from our final sponsor this episode, Segura. We know it can be difficult to make time for ourselves in this fast-paced world we live in. The stress of work, family, and the seemingly never-ending list of responsibilities we face every day are bound to take their toll. Take a step back, enjoy the finer things in life with Segura. The next generation of cigars online. Join Segura and be the first to see cutting-edge products, exclusive offers, and limited edition gear. Whether you're looking for top-shelf brands like Whether you're looking for top-shelf brands like Davidoff, industry staples like Fuente, or super rare blends from Viaje, Segura is your one-stop shop for all your cigar needs. Explore its curated selection of industry content that includes reviews, food and beverage pairings, beginner questions, and much more. Join the Segura Lounge and connect with fellow cigar enthusiasts alongside its staff, experts, and manufacturers, and be part of a one-of-a-kind cigar community. Get back to yourself. Visit Segura.com. That's Segura, Cigora.com, and use the checkout code REVIEW10. That's REVIEW10 to receive 10% off your first purchase. Segura, shop, connect, share. Again, check it out at Segura.com. So Maddie, Stacey Abrams is a woman for all seasons. She's a romance novelist, she's an activist and a gubernatorial candidate, and also we learned this week a cardiologist. She said at an event that the so-called heartbeat that countless millions of delighted parents have believed they've heard on ultrasounds around 6 weeks is a mirage created by the patriarchy to repress women. What do you make of it?
It's just a total detachment from reality, but it's a willful detachment of reality. And it's something that we've just come to expect from progressive politicians. And it's very selective. You know, the same people who say things like this, like it's not a, there's no heartbeat, it doesn't exist, it's a manufactured sound, want us to believe that men can get pregnant, want us to believe that a man can become a woman. I mean, it's just obviously on its face absurd, but there's something more insidious going on as well, which is if you think of George Orwell's essay Politics and the English Language, he talks about how people use language and twist it to justify things that just are not justifiable, to make murder seem okay. And that's what's going on with this heartbeat, turning heartbeat into cardiac activity or whatever other jargon. It's an attempt to dehumanize the unborn, to encourage people to not see them as persons, see them as something subhuman or separate. And if you're invested in that ideology, then you'll go along with it. And if you're not, then you won't. But it is completely dishonest and just a sort of despicable claim.
Yeah. So Charlie, just the battle over this and the attempts by the other side to just create alternate language that avoids acknowledging the reality here. I mean, you've had people tweeting, come on, it's not a fetal heartbeat, it's cardiac activity. You know, it's not a heartbeat, it's just electrical pulses. You know, you're not actually hearing literally the sound of a heartbeat because it's amplified and created by the ultrasound machine. So actually it would sound totally different, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm just grateful to Stacey Abrams for blowing the lid off of big ultrasound, which for years has been manufacturing these fake sounds to hold up the patriarchy. I mean, I can remember with my two kids when we went in for really early appointments, you know, at one point the technician would go into the other room and then pick up the phone and say, yes, master, like that. And we wonder what the hell was going on. But now we know it's part of the big, I mean, what the hell is she talking about? What the hell is she talking about? And why has the assembled media jumped to defend her? It's really a great example of what conservatives complain about all the time. She didn't just make a ridiculous medical claim, but she coupled it with a conspiracy theory. And I wonder to what end. So I agree with everything Maddie said. This is a ridiculous, Orwellian, euphemistic attempt. But she doesn't follow the logic of her own attempt through to its conclusion. So let's assume that an unborn child is not really an unborn child. That a heartbeat or a proto-heartbeat is not really a heartbeat. That the fingernails that the unborn child has by that point started to develop can't be called fingernails. We have to call them something else. Badoo-badoo. But at 10 weeks, and this is the argument that Glenn Kessler made in the Washington Post, it's the argument that all of the but actually people have made. But at 10 weeks, that changes. So at 6 weeks, not a heartbeat, a fake heartbeat, conspiracy heartbeat, electrical pulse heartbeat. But at 10 weeks, real heartbeat. Aha, conservatives, gotcha. All right, so Stacey Abrams is in favor of restrictions at 10 weeks, is she? No, she's not. So why? Why does it matter? I mean, she's imbuing the actual heartbeat as she sees it. The medical heartbeat, the real heartbeat, the cosmically important heartbeat with this importance. She's telling people who think that it begins 4 weeks earlier, or in my view, really, at the moment of conception, because that's the point at which the life is created. And if you leave it alone, it will grow into a person. She's drawing this distinction. She's saying not 6-10, not 6-10. But she opposes a 10-week ban. So the thing with the heartbeat, the thing with the human behavior, the thing that it exhibits, in her view, the same medical, biological characteristics as I do, as a 37-year-old, can still be killed at will. So I don't understand the point. I mean, the reason that conservatives, or anyone who's pro-life, I shouldn't say conservative, the reason that anyone who is pro-life has honed in on the heartbeat is that it's a neat way of illustrating that the unborn child has signs of life that we all recognize. It doesn't have to be a heartbeat. It could be brain activity. It could be movement. It could be the development of a skeleton. It doesn't matter. But the heartbeat's particularly poignant. You can hear it. It's what we test for when we check if someone who's been injured is still alive. It's how we know someone has died. So we pick heartbeat and we say 6 weeks. That's why we do it. And she's moving it forward 4 weeks, but then still rejecting the premise. It's baffling to me. And I think what is going on here is fairly typical and fairly human. And that is an unwillingness to accept the truth, to accept reality where it interferes with a deeply held political commitment. We've seen this. Human beings are capable, if they wish to, of talking themselves into positions that post-rationalize and justify their political precepts. And unfortunately, human beings are capable of talking themselves into the dehumanization of those who are different or who exhibit circumstances that are not akin to their own. And we've seen this over and over and over again. And I suspect that's what we're doing here. And as Maddie says, this is actually one of the topics of that George Orwell essay. Now, Orwell at that point was mainly preoccupied with war. The examples that he gives are about empire and about war. And I suspect Stacey Abrams would be able to grasp euphemism when it was deployed inside that context. Progressives have long pointed out, correctly in my view, that some of the words that we use to describe dropping bombs and killing people are a little bit too abstract. Collateral damage, kinetic activity, and so on and so forth. But for some reason, they just can't or won't see the same tendency in themselves when it comes to the dehumanization of unborn children.
So, MBD, does this feel like potentially a moment to you where Republicans, perhaps the first time post-Dobbs, can get some footing in this argument?
I don't know if elected Republicans are too afraid of their own shadows to get involved in this argument, but that shouldn't stop us. Yeah, I fear Republicans haven't joined the affray. They've been too frightened by these polls after Dobbs to get involved in the argument. But, you know, we can see, like, this is a good sign for pro-lifers, right? This is actually a sign of progress we're making, right? Because now, when Dobbs was litigated in front of the Supreme Court, the arguments there were all about our abstract rights, our the history of abortion law in the United States, what, you know, what the 14th Amendment implies or means, or what the this is moving the debate to actual legislation that would protect children. And the more the pro-life movement has been able to ground people in biological realities, the more they've been able to vindicate the rights of the unborn. So this is all to the good. And, you know, it's funny because this Stacey Abrams report came the same week that some scientists in the UK released a study showing that unborn children react very strongly to flavors, that if a mother eats carrots, unborn children in the womb will make faces that are like more like laughter and smiling. And if mothers eat bitter kale, unborn children make like sour and kind of frowny faces.
Another reason that the rise of kale has been one of the worst culinary trends in American food.
Even a baby can sense it.
Yeah, where did kale come from? Why did kale become a thing?
I like kale.
Really?
Yeah, I like it. The sweet green salads with the, Harvest Bowl kale base?
So you like it more than just standard lettuce?
I would say more, but in certain contexts.
This is your last appearance on the podcast. Yeah.
It's just the way it looks, the texture, just...
But anyway, it's
nice.
I'm glad the Democrats are forced to talk this way because they sound psychotic. I mean, you know, it's just like when you look at a picture of, you know, an illustration of an unborn child, like you can do exactly what they do with the heartbeat. You could say, oh, that's not a face. That's an orifice where the nostrils will be. There's another two orifices where the eyes will be. I mean, you're not actually changing any persuadable person's mind by saying that. You're actually most likely repelling them because you're demonstrating what Maddie said. You are literally dehumanizing the human.
Yeah.
And
I mean, it just goes to, you gotta be incrementalist. Pick a time you want your restriction, and then talk about what every single expecting parent thinks and feels about that child.
But this is why they don't. This is why they say in almost every case, not what Stacey Abrams said, that was her mistake. This is why they say, I trust the woman. They want to abstract it out to that level because you really don't want to get into a conversation about what an unborn child looks like, or you end up here and you end up sounding, as Michael says, psychotic, because you're saying, oh, that's not a heartbeat. That's just the electrical signals produced by what will become the heart. It's crazy.
And you see, there are pro-life advocates like Lila Rose who become so effective at doing exactly what Rich said, which is talking about how parents really feel, the trepidation they feel when they get an adverse diagnosis for their unborn child. You know, you do have to talk about that and ground this in not like... You can't just talk about this like you are a professor of Thomas Aquinas's philosophy Oxford. You actually have to talk about it like a mom or dad.
So, Maddie, another development on the culture war front. Glenn Youngkin issued new guidance related to trans issues in the schools, pushing back and reversing the guidance issued by our old friend Ralph Northam in 2021, who wanted the schools basically to just go all in on gender ideology. This is a little hard to believe, but it must be true because it's in our editorial on this policy shift. But the Northam guidance says schools that adopted these model policies would, quote, allow students to assert a name and gender pronouns that reflect their gender identity without any substantiating evidence, close quote.
Yeah. So, I mean, the key point about this is it's reversing the previous aggression. And so many of these steps in the right direction, be it this from Glenn Youngkin or be it Ron DeSantis' support of the Parental Rights in Education Act, it's a defensive measure. What came before should never have happened. We should never have had policy in schools saying that children should be socially transitioned, which is a complex and controversial psychological treatment for gender dysphoria. A lot of these kids don't even have gender dysphoria. They don't even meet the diagnostic criteria. They've just picked up on a trend and want to act out, as kids often do. So first of all, we had school personnel who just aren't qualified to do that, transitioning children. But then you also had the really sinister lack of transparency, where schools were, it was sometimes actually their official policy that they would not involve parents unless instructed to by the child. And I think what Glenn Youngkin's done here is to say, we're not going to do anything that comes between the children and their parents. And a lot of this gender ideology is just completely not our job. It doesn't belong in school. We're going to keep this out. If there are, I think that it also had a sort of accommodation in there. Like if there are people who are confused about their sex, whatever, you can make a case by case accommodation. You can have single use restrooms. So this is necessary. Of course, it's going to be painted and has been painted as aggression. But again, I would just underscore the fact that this is defensive.
Yeah, there's a astonishing piece of data that Guy Benson highlighted the other day. So he went to Northwestern and someone leaked to him the Northwestern student freshman survey. And 55% of these kids said they think about their identity all the time. You know, where's that coming from? You know, we're doing that to them. We created the culture that is empowering these bizarre obsessions. Charlie Cook, exit question to you. We will win the fight over trans ideology in the public schools, yes or no?
Yes.
MBD?
I think so, but it actually, we may see a lot of damage to public schools in the meantime.
Oh, no.
Well, no, I mean that I'm not. No. I was tempted to almost say, like, no, we won't win in the public schools, but we'll destroy the public schools. I wish that were the answer, but it's not. So, but I think we'll win.
Matt?
I think so, but I think there's a lot more to come in terms of pushback.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I agree with everything that's been said. I think we will win. I think this stuff is so offensive and just violates every rule of common sense for most people. And the public schools are just firmly within the political realm that we will win this fight, but it will be difficult and it's incredibly insidious. And the other side is determined to seep it in through every means possible. With that, let me do a quick plug for NR Plus, digital subscription service at nationalreview.com, your way around our metered paywall, your way if you sign up and log in to see 90% fewer ads, your way if you want to dig deeper into our community, to comment on articles and blog posts, to be part of our private Facebook group, to be invited to exclusive calls and events. We have one that's coming up here real soon on the West Coast, a meetup with our writers and editors. If you are in the appropriate place, and have signed up for NR Plus, you will be getting an exclusive invitation to that, which we're looking forward to very much. So great deal all around. We have first-time deals running at any given moment for people who have not had the wisdom to sign up yet. So if you haven't signed up for NR Plus, please do so and join tens of thousands of your fellow National Review readers as a member of NR Plus. Let's hit a few other things before we go. Maddie, you saw The Music Man on Broadway and got a discounted rush ticket.
Yes. If you have to kind of know the system a little bit, but if you have the advantage of living in New York, you can queue up sometimes very early in the morning, but I went at 9 a.m. so wasn't too bad. Before the box office opens, and you can get a rush ticket. So I think standard ticket prices for The Music Man starring Hugh Jackman is around like $300. And I got a ticket for myself and my fiance at $50 each. So we had great seats and it was just a wonderful show. Jay Nordlinger says it's the great American musical. And I think I agree with that. So yeah, it's a good trick to know about rush tickets. If you have the time and the resources to do it, then you should.
MBD, been listening to Elvis and Costello.
So Elvis Costello's album, 2002 album, When I Was Cruel, just somehow ended up back on my turntable this week. And it is a huge return to his 1980s form. And I can't believe it is now a 20-year-old album itself, because I had already considered it something like that belonged to his late career, but now I'm becoming so middle-aged or elderly that his late career is my childhood.
So literally your turntable?
Yeah.
Nice. Charlie Cook, 9 holes of golf with your son.
Absolutely. He is taking golf lessons, pretty much. Has to, where I live. It's golf world down here, and he's enjoying it. And his homework this week as such was to play 9 holes. So of course he needed someone to go with him. I'm not a great golfer, although I did have enormous fun playing. So I took him along with my wife and our 4-year-old. I think our 4-year-old was the least into it, but probably needs a little time. But no, it was lovely. The weather was absolutely perfect, probably a little too hot if anything. And I got to see what it looks like from being on the golf course rather than watching from the side.
I'd love to play golf if it didn't take so much time to learn the appropriate technique and then it didn't take so much time to play. But just in isolation, I think it's a wonderful game. But
I skipped the learning part.
Just yeah. But it doesn't make it quite as fun. Not, I would have to drive 3 separate times to get any decent shot off. And you can't just go, if that's your condition of your game, you just can't go out with a foursome and subject everyone else to that. So here in the leafy suburbs, I've been dealing with brazen chipmunks. Chipmunks you associate with timidity. They live in holes. They run everywhere because they have so many predators and are completely defenseless. But in our garage, I'll sometimes open the garage door and take a chair and just sit in the driveway on a nice day and do my work out there. And these chipmunks, they'll like run like almost like in between my feet, just incredibly close to me, and then into the garage because there's bird seed they can grab. And they don't worry about me doing anything about it, rightly as it turns out, and don't worry about getting caught in the garage if I close the garage door. So in the interest of the welfare of these chipmunks, 1, and 2, and my wife not getting incredibly angry at me at a chipmunk showing up in the garage, late at night, and maybe making a dash into the house, I have to make sure I'm every time I step out of the driveway and spend some time out there, I need to make sure I'm closing the garage door to stop these brazen chipmunks from undertaking their raid. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
My pick is right at the top of the site right now. It's Caroline Downey's report, Inside Student Activists' Cancel Campaign Against a Youngkin Appointee to the University of Virginia Board. Caroline's done a lot of great work for us, and just the whole news team, I think, has been on a roll lately. And this is one of the the best and meatiest items they have. So go check them out.
Maddie Kearns, what's your pick?
My pick is Mark Wright's recent writings about Russia. I just think he's really, really strong on this. And I've certainly learned a lot through reading his columns.
Joy Cook.
My pick is on the homepage today. It's called Is the Pandemic Over or Not? By Pradeep J. Shankar, who I think is a doctor and also writes from us from time to time and is pretty prolific on Twitter. And it was very useful. I'm not a doctor. He runs through the arguments on either side, but he points out that Joe Biden's comment, the one that got all the pushback, including from within his own White House, was not an anomaly. In fact, Biden's been saying that the pandemic's over for quite a while.
So my pick is by MBD, who made us this way, dealing with trans issues, and it really a profound, I would say even soulful take on the issue that I recommend to everyone. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Maddie. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to NetChoice, Tommy John, and Segura. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.